This hour, we'll get up close and personal with a crematorium.
It's going to kind of look like a hearth. Let me turn the power on.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We fear our own deaths, and we fear losing those we love. But for some people, death is a daily fact of life. This hour, I'll talk with Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City and Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. We'll talk about how we deal with death in our culture. We'll get some insight into what it's like to care for the dead and explore some ideas that could make us all more comfortable with the inevitable. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We each have to learn to deal with death in our own way, but many people feel that as a culture, we don't prepare people for the reality of death. The work of caring for the dead is largely hidden, but today we're going to go behind those closed doors. This hour, I'll talk with Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, and Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. Last week, Iowa Public Radio producer Claire Roth visited the Lensing Funeral Home Crematory to find out what it's like.
Here at our funeral home, the crematory is actually in a regular part of the buildings versus being in a garage setting. So the reason we do that is that way if there's rituals, for instance, when any families or something, they can come right in off our main room. That what you're seeing in front of you is actually an electronic hydraulic hoist. So many times we will bring the person in, they're in a container, and so this will go up and down because the crematory the entry to the crematory is about 3.5 feet off the floor. So usually we have to lift the person, up. And so that we put the body on, it raises it, and then we would roll the body in. The door is about 450 pounds. And when we open it, you're going to see basically it's going to kind of look like a hearth. Let me turn the power on there. So as you look into the chamber, the cremation chamber, there's actually two parts. So part of it is it's all lined with fire brick. And when it's brand new, of course, the floor would be totally smooth. But it's like anything, like a kiln, that over time it wears. And we have to replace the floor off and on or repair the floor or whatever. It usually takes about 2.5 to 3 hours.
Does someone have to be in here with it while that happens?
No, I mean, once we place the body in, we make sure there's a thing on here that says safe run and afterburner. And what that means is there's two levels to it. So when the cremation, it actually starts underneath the main floor of the crematory itself, where the body is the air is pulled down below, and there's baffles that goes through to cool it and to clean it. So that way when the heat escapes, it's escaping, I think it's around 1200 degrees, but it cools everything. So if somebody said, oh my goodness, I'm getting X out of the, it's very clean going out. After the cremation, we have a metal rake broom sort of thing that we clean out the crematory, and the bone, it becomes very brittle, so it will break apart, but it's in larger pieces. And so then what we do, it goes into a tray, and the temperature of the crematory will vary, but it's usually between 1400 to 1600 degrees.
And I can feel heat coming off of it now.
So what happens is we did a cremation last evening, and so you're still feeling the heat from that because it's absorbed into the brick. After the cremated remains are in the tray, we will come over, lay them out, and let them cool. Take out things like, for instance, I have pins in my knee. So if those things, titanium knees, discard any of that so that all the family would be getting back are the cremated remains, the bone. We process the cremated remains so they're in tinier fragments or powder-like, so that's really unidentifiable what it would be. So, and then what we do is we'll take the cremated remains and put the cremated remains in a bag, and we'll have an identification tag, which is like this. and it has a number on it, and it accompanies the body throughout the whole process. So it has our name on it, and it has the number on it, and so that we can always track who, you know, has been cremated. And then the cremated remains, this will go on those. So like if the family, let's say they moved out somewhere and somebody's always wondered who that was, we keep a cremation log, and it's always logged in who it is, what time we did the cremation. You know, many times we'll actually have to divide the cremated remains up. So we may divide them up into different little bags. So somebody may want to, you know, maybe somebody's scattering them. But, you know, many times somebody wants just to keep a little bit of them. So there's actually cremation jewelry that we can get, or little keepsake urns, or there's actually a company called Memory Glass in California that we send away, and they do paperweights, which are really kind of cool. But everybody is different. You can have one somebody in the family that thinks that's really cool, and you have somebody else in the family that thinks it's the oddest thing they ever heard. You know, so it's no right or wrong. It's all personal, whatever somebody really wants.
That visit to the crematory was produced by Iowa Public Radio's Claire Roth, and with me now is Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for letting us visit you and find out what it's like at your place of work. With me is also Caitlin Doty. She's the author of the new book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back with both of you to talk about how you got involved in this industry. And Caitlin, you were certain for a very long time that you wanted to work in this field. When did you decide that?
Well, I don't know that I was certain at first. I know that I wanted to be involved with death somehow, but I thought it was going to be more academic. I thought it was going to be more going to graduate school and studying death that way. But I thought that I could learn a lot from actually going into the field and seeing what people were really doing and how we were handling death in America. So that's what I did, and I actually have just stayed in it ever since. And that was, I guess, about a little over seven years ago now.
And you had an experience when you were very young that really terrified you, and it also sort of started you on this pathway. Can you tell me what happened?
Sure. When I was young, about 8 years old, I was at a local mall, and it was one of those two-story malls, and I saw a young girl fall from the second story to the ground and hit the ground, and everything ensued. And to that point, because I lived in America, I didn't really have a sense of death like I would have if I was a child 100 years ago, when people died all the time and people saw death all the time. So I had been kind of sheltered from it up until that point. So it really, really did terrify me because I didn't have any context for it.
And that made you really phobic about death from that point on. You were afraid that your mom would die or that your dad would die, right?
Yeah, I developed some, I guess, OCD behaviors are probably what they would be called, routines and rituals to keep everything in check. And, you know, it's always a question of if you're into death, is it nature versus nurture? And I don't think that happening is the reason that I'm interested in being involved in death and how death works in our culture. But I'm sure that it did inspire it, because I don't want children especially, to go through the same fear of death that I had as a child.
So this book begins when you got a job at age 23 working in a crematory in the San Francisco area. Tell me about that first job.
Well, I applied for about 6 months, because it's not necessarily, especially if you're young and you don't have a mortuary degree, it's not necessarily easy to get a job in the funeral industry. It's not like they just have a ton of them on Craigslist and you apply and show up. So I finally got this job as a crematory operator, which you don't need a license for. It's an on-job licensing in California. And that was my first job in the industry. And I started right away on the first day learning how to cremate the bodies and how to prepare the bodies. And it was intense, because I knew what I was getting into, but you can never entirely know what you're getting into. So it was quite a wake-up call for me.
And you really wanted that job because of this fascination that you had with death.
Right. Well, and again, it started as an academic remove. It started as something that I was looking at from above. But then there's no way when you're actually working with the families and the grief and the bodies that you can't get personally involved somehow. you can learn to distance yourself from it because you wouldn't be able to do your job otherwise, but you can't stay completely above it all. You're always going to bring part of yourself and your own experience into it.
And Michael, how did you get involved in this business?
Very interesting. I started out in college. I'm originally from Cedar Rapids and wanted to be a doctor, wanted to be a pediatrician, and heard from a friend about this great deal. This is 1970, where 71, where you could live in, there were three funeral homes in town. Each funeral home had an apartment, and each apartment had like two college students, and you answered the phone, and when a death occurred, we'd go to the hospital at night. And I'd had two death experiences in my life. One was my grandfather, and one was a fourth grade friend who drowned. And the only reason I moved into the funeral home was because I thought I could save money for my parents so we wouldn't have to pay for an apartment.
All right. So you could live there rent-free if you took
right,
on these duties.
Exactly. And that's how I started and actually had no interest in it. It made me kind of creepy. But after living there 2 years, I switched my major to elementary education and thought, you know, a lot of it's about the living. And I met some really great people. And so I thought, well, let's try this. If I don't like it, I'll come back and teach. But here we are.
So in some ways for you, it was in spite of a discomfort with death,
right,
with the job that you would be doing, but because of the families you were inspired,
yeah,
you felt like you could really touch people?
I do think that there is a misconception that it's all about the body, and there is that portion, but for me, it's really all about the living. I mean, because you really meet some really wonderful people that are really in, you know, hard time in their life. And I think sometimes they share, especially in maybe Caitlin, maybe you could agree with this too. But I mean, communities make a difference. And where we're at is a much smaller community than, say, San Francisco and or L.A. And so there are definitely ties that bond you over the years, you know. So you're serving a family years and years, you know. So you get to know people, you know, more than just that one instance.
And I'm sure that really makes it a different experience as well. And we'll talk about more in a moment. I'm talking with Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. Also with me today, Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. We're talking about the business of death. We're talking about caring for dead bodies this hour, but also talking about how we view death in our culture. And we'll talk about some ideas for helping people become more comfortable with death in our culture as well. We'll continue our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the work of caring for the dead in our society. We're also talking about how we deal with death in our culture and some ideas for helping people get more comfortable with this inevitable part of life. With me this hour, Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, and Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Do you feel that you're more comfortable dealing with death than others? Why do you think that might be? What do you think is it about our culture that leads people to be so uncomfortable with it? We'd love to hear your thoughts. 866-780-9100. And Caitlin, right before the break, Michael was talking about how he got into this business because he wanted to touch the families and to work with people, and how for him the work is not entirely about the living, obviously, but a lot of it is about the living. When you started working at the crematory, I get the impression you were surprised by how much interaction you had with the families of those that were dead.
Absolutely. And it is about the living. And for me, the most fascinating part is I guess, people's relationship to the dead and how it changes over the course of what you do with the body and how, I guess, those just relationships work in our culture, and depending on what kind of religion you had or race you had and the differences and the similarities. But yeah, it was a lot of working with the families. And honestly, especially in a big city like San Francisco or Los Angeles, a lot of it is working with the bureaucracies too, to get the death certificate filed and to get the health department involved and the coroner involved. And it's not like you just get to go down to the local bureau and have it filed. It's a lot more complicated.
And you pointed out something in your book that I think is very important, and that is that, you know, so many people die every year. I think the figure you quoted was 2.5 million people in the United States die every year. And most of us don't know any of those people. Most of us are completely separated from that. Maybe we read about it in the newspaper, we hear about it on the radio, see about it on television, but obviously not all of us are losing someone we know every single year. And there's a real divide. Now, of course, working in the crematory, you plunged headfirst into that world. You saw those numbers. You encountered so many deaths.
Sure. It's coming in and going, oh, here you all are. And you know theoretically that all of these people are dying, but you just don't see them. And in some smaller towns in the U.S., there still is much more of a connection. You see the hearses going down the streets and the funeral cars, and you have more of a connection. But in larger cities, there's a whole system of denial in place. There are unmarked vans that carry the dead to and from places. They come out of the back doors of hospitals or nursing homes in the middle of the night. And there's not a sense of seeing the dead anymore the way, again, 100 years ago would have been a very different experience. 100 years ago, we had people in the parlors of our homes. And so you would walk down the street and you would know who was in mourning and you would know where the dead were. But that's just not the case anymore.
Well, and we also tend to shield our children from death, don't we?
We do. And that's something that I don't agree with. I think that kids can handle it. And I think if it's done correctly, a child can absolutely be introduced to death at a very young age in a rational and open way, and know that if they have questions or concerns or fears, that those are totally normal and that there are adults who aren't terrified of death available to answer them.
You know, you talked earlier about the experience that you had as a child watching a girl you believe fall to her death, and you never got the full story after that. But after you saw that, did your parents try to help you through that? Did they explain what had happened? Did you talk about death?
Not really. And I think that they were under the impression, they were wonderful parents, I think they were under the impression that talking about it would make it worse, that they didn't want to remind me of it. They didn't want to call attention to it or make me feel weird or pathological. And in retrospect, I don't know that that was the best way to handle it. Because I always think that an open dialogue is best, because children left to their own devices think up all kinds of magical things that when you say grandpa's sleeping, you might very well think that grandpa is under the ground in his casket awake in there.
Right.
And because they're so literal and so magical at the same time. So a child's brain left to its own devices, you can't count on it to come to the rational conclusion about things.
Well, and Michael, you had early experiences as well, encountering deaths in your community. Your parents took a different approach.
Yeah, I remember my first experience, which I won't go into great detail, but I remember going to the funeral home only because I probably was in third grade, and that was really, I think, my very first experience. And it's funny, looking back, my mother, I remember going along, and I don't remember anything about a body. And the one thing I remember is that I keep thinking the casket looked like wicker. And I know that wasn't the case. But it's funny because I think it was kind of watching the people. And then the person who died was a younger person that I'd gone to school with, but I didn't know them. So I think the experience was important for me because there was a distance of not knowing the person. But I was able to be introduced in that way. I think the idea of the fear of death, I don't know that I even fear death. I think I fear how I die. I think when I look at myself, it's like I feel like there's many times a lot of things worse than death. If you were tortured or different things like that. But I think it's how you know, I kind of get fearful about, like, God, am I going to go this way? Am I going to go that way? But I also know I can't dwell on it. But I agree with Caitlin. It's like children are children take cues from us as adults. And I think even within the last couple of weeks, I can think of services we've had that I was so thankful that the parent was crying, and because they had younger children, like maybe 8 or 9 or something. And there's something really powerful for a child, I think, to be able to see their father shed tears or their mother, because it makes them understand that it's okay to grieve and that that is a natural part of losing somebody.
Do you feel like maybe your fears about how you die? You've probably seen pretty much everything, Michael.
I've seen a lot, but I think my fear is this, that this may sound very odd. It's like I don't want to go too quick, but I don't want to go too long. It's like I want enough time to be able to say goodbye, and I don't know how long that is, but it's like, but I don't want to have to suffer too much. But I think that's human.
We all want that.
Yeah.
I think.
And I think hospice, kind of backing up with Caitlin, the one wonderful thing about a lot of the hospices, at least around here, many are home-based or something. So a lot of deaths still, not a lot, but many do occur in the home. So there is family around. So.
And Caitlin, you referenced the incredibly popular HBO show, 6 Feet Under, when you started, and Michael's nodding. He loved it as well, when you started working in this crematory. And that was a show that connected with so many people and I think really tapped into our sort of fascination with death and our curiosity about what goes on in the business of taking care of the dead. In working at the crematory, were there things when you started, I mean, having sort of come from this period where you had a fascination, were there things that shocked you or did you feel prepared?
I don't think you're ever totally prepared. You can read about things, but the experience of actually being in the presence of the dead is a totally different thing, because we have a sense that the dead body is both sacred and profane. And this is something I say all the time. On one hand, it's beautiful and it's important, and the family thinks it's so important that it be treated with respect. And on the other hand, oh, it's creepy, it's disgusting, oh, get me away from it. And we're able to hold those two things in our heads at the same time about the same dead body. And having that experience and being able to experience it firsthand and be there and prepare them and shave their face and wash their body is an intense experience that I don't know that you can just describe to someone and have them understand it.
And you have some strong feelings about different aspects of the funeral industry as well. I mean, obviously, so many of us encounter the funeral industry at a time when we are very sad, and a lot of us aren't prepared to make these decisions. In some cases we are, in some cases we aren't, but all of a sudden we're faced with very, very big decisions. Caitlin, you write a little bit about some of the history of the funeral industry in our country and how it became how it is today. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch?
Sure. Originally, again, as I said, it was the families that took care of the dead. And for a variety of reasons, starting in the early 20th century, we had a medicalization of death, meaning that the dying were taken out of the home, and then a rise in the funeral industry, which means the actual dead body and care for the dead body was taken out of the home and put into the hands of professionals. And in some ways, that's good. Nobody is saying we should go back to our hugely high infant mortality rates or anything. But on the other hand, there's a lack of family involvement. And I love in the opening piece where you were talking about having the space for rituals at the funeral home. And that's so important. And a lot of funeral homes don't have that. They don't have a lot of room for family involvement anymore. And that's what we're missing. And that's what I hope that we can, by having an open discussion, that we're able to get back.
Well, and Michael, I know that you have some strong feelings about this as well, and the opportunity for the family to interact with the body of their loved one if they want to.
I agree with Caitlin. I think out of fairness to the funeral profession, I think the one thing in her book she writes about Jessica Mitford, which is a wonderful – I like that particular chapter. But I think the funeral profession, the whole – group has tried to change to some degree. And I think there has been, because of consumerization, there's been more openness in this. Not that there doesn't need to be more change, but that's true with everything. And I don't know that you can always get it totally open. But I think you do find, for instance, here in our community, if we have a number of services where somebody will come in to bathe the body because it's part of the ritual, and place the body in a homemade casket or those sorts of things, different things. So I think what Caitlin and I agree on would be that, it's the openness of the caregiver to do that. I think sometimes you also have to be cautious, not from the funeral role, but you've got to make sure that the person overseeing this family ritual isn't overpowering the family, that this is something the family really wants, that it's not because of a bigger power coming down saying, sure, this is how we have to do it.
Well, and that must be a very...
From a religious standpoint,
right,
you know what I'm saying,
right,
versus
right,
the funeral. And,
but that must be a very interesting part of your job as well, because when somebody comes in, how do you decide what options you'll tell them about? How do you get a feel for what they might want?
Usually, I'm sure every area is different. I think I don't know that people really, they want to know a certain amount, but there's also a part that I don't know how much they want to know. I mean, it is amazing to me sometimes still that somebody, and Caitlin mentions this book, can be dying for 6 months and they don't talk about it until the day before they die, and then they call the funeral home, and it's like you've had this period to actually seek out thoughts and all of that. So I think for us it's a matter of listening, not being forceful in any way, but I do think it's important for whoever's providing this to the family to give them some guidance. I mean, not telling them what to do, but expressing options, and in cases where maybe you've had an example in suicide, expressing to a family saying, from my experience, other families have learned from this, and then letting them decide.
I want to bring Brenda into the conversation on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Brenda.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted to say my husband passed away about 3 years ago unexpectedly, and they took his body to somewhere far away to do an autopsy. And then I had him cremated. And we went to Gay and Chia, and I had 2 12-year-olds, a 10-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And my boys were just really curious about what was happening. So I took them there, and Mr. Chia took them back and showed them the oven. And he had just finished cremating my husband's body. And the boys got to feel the ashes, and they were still warm. They were in a plastic bag, but it really helped them realize what was happening, because they didn't see the body, and they weren't there, when the coroner was there, and all that stuff. So he just talked them through it and told them what happened, and it really was wonderful.
Well, Brenda, I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you so much for sharing your experience today. I think, Caitlin, you write quite a bit about this in your book as well, talking about, for example, when you go to retrieve a body from someone's home, you go with a man who may not have the best people skills day to day, but he has such a wonderful manner with the families in a way that he can walk them through what's going on, this very frightening situation where a body of someone they love is being taken out of their home.
Right. And that, first of all, that is a wonderful story. And the more people tell stories like that, the more that people know that that's an option. And so I really commend you for sharing that story publicly. And yeah, absolutely. And like Michael was talking about, the idea of just when a family comes into the funeral home, they don't necessarily want someone who's overly sympathetic. They want someone who's competent. They want someone who knows what they're talking about, who knows the options and knows how to explain things. And you work with the family to judge their comfort level and what it is that they want from you. So if they seem completely cut off from it, you don't force the issue. But if someone says, I don't know about cremation, what actually goes on? You have to be ready to explain it to them in a very straightforward, you know, sort of at the level that they want to be at. And it is a social game of trying to understand what they want from you and being the most competent practitioner possible.
And you also write about your own personal journey about finding that right approach, not wanting to seem too sympathetic, not wanting to be too cheerful, wanting to be confident and friendly. But that's an interesting story that you share in the book. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back in just a moment. I'm talking with Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, and also with Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. You're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about the work of caring for the dead in our culture and how we feel about death in our culture. With me this hour is Caitlin Doty, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, and Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. We were talking earlier about the different things that people want as they go through the experience of setting up a funeral when they've lost someone, or not even necessarily setting up a funeral. Some people choose not to go that route. And Michael, we actually talked about you on this program not mm-hmm. that long ago when I was interviewing Elizabeth Hindman about mm-hmm. her experience. She lost a baby to stillbirth, and she's written a memoir about it called Ghost Belly. And she talks about you because you were the person who cared for her child, and she was having a very difficult time with this death. Of course, it's a moment when she expected to be welcoming a new life, and instead she was mourning the loss of her son. And you actually encouraged her to take her baby home. And I guess that's something that it never occurred to me was an option. Most of us would never think that we could do something like that before the funeral. What made you suggest that to her?
Well, Elizabeth, she is such a dynamic woman, and I think she's very well educated. She also, I think she had a good sense of feeling what she might need. And I don't know that I'd always offer that to everybody, because that would not be, not everybody would want to do that. But for her, I know I've had a Japanese family that's done that before, and I know Elizabeth has done that, and she needed to do that. And it wasn't like she took the baby home for 4 days or something, you know, but I believe she actually might have kept the baby overnight. I can't remember. Yeah. I think she did. But she would also come into the funeral because we didn't do the service for a week, I think, something like that. And so she would come in every other day or something to rock the baby. I think everybody is different. That would not be for everybody. For her, that was important. And I think you kind of get those feelings. And I don't know that I would always offer that except with dialogue, because some people would feel really uncomfortable with that. And but she was very open to that and needed to do that. But there's nothing wrong with doing that or anything illegal with doing that. So that's kind of how that came about.
Well, a lot of people have a real sense of discomfort with a dead body.
Right.
Suddenly this person has gone from being alive and the person they love to being a corpse, and suddenly the idea of being with that body or touching that body
right.
is really difficult for them to comprehend. So you must see a lot of different reactions.
Which is very interesting to me, and Caitlin, I'm sure, can share this too. I find it interesting that here, and I try to express this, I think, and when we have tours at the funeral with college students or something, is that, you know, there is nothing to be afraid of the body. Here's somebody that you've cared for your whole life or whatever. But I think what you're afraid of is what that body represents. And nobody wants to see a loved one who's died. I mean, who wants to do that? And yet it is a part of life. And so there is, I think, the idea of ritual is so important in what we do, because it doesn't matter if it's a religious ritual, whatever it is, you need to be able to say goodbye in some form. And so for some people, that may be helping dress the body and maybe touching the body. I mean, even in this Ebola epidemic, you look at all the things in West Africa and the change of funeral customs, that's got to be very, very, very difficult for a culture that is very hands-on. Mm-hmm. This is a cultural change that's got to be very almost offensive and scary. So I think that's, you know, for us as Americans to embrace it, the hospice movement's really helped in that sense. But we still, you know, I don't know that we'll ever get to the point of being right. totally open about that. I think that's human.
Well, and Caitlin, having worked in the crematory and had many experiences, you write quite a bit about when families come to witness the cremation and they have the opportunity, at least in the crematory that you worked in, of pushing the button to send the body through this process. And you came to feel that, for example, when your father died, you wanted to be there. You wanted to be the one to do that. Why do you think that would be important to you?
Well, because, again, like we were just talking about, this person, my father, took care of me my whole life, and he's an important part of my life. And time again, you hear the idea of just the conceptual idea of a dead body can be kind of freaky and scary, but when it's your actual loved one, when it is your baby, when it is your father, when it is your husband, that discomfort can be overcome because it's a dead body, so it's you're distant from it, and it is a shell of the person who is gone, but it was someone you love, and it represents their death, which is hard, but it also represents their life, which is something that's very important to you and you cherish. So people are often able to overcome their initial discomfort after they spend some time with the body. And when my father dies, which he will do, I would love to be able to be as involved as possible. I would love to be able to wash his body and sit with his body and see the little changes that are what death is and are very natural. And then if he chooses to be cremated, to be there for the cremation and to watch him be loaded in and know that I was there with him the whole time.
And Michael, did you want to add something?
I agree with Caitlin. It's interesting to watch in our society, but it's the way our society is, I think, that whenever we have many of our cultural, you know, groups, like many of the Asians in this community, if we have a service, they will be there and press the button and begin the process and become very involved. However, if I offered that to most families, I think I would do that, but I think many of them look at me like, no, that's nobody, I don't want to do that. They would go to the cemetery for a committal of cremated remains or wherever, or scatter them. But the idea of being that close, and I think that may be how cremation in this country, in our country, has come about, that it was very disposal-like initially versus other cultures in around the world, like England and different places. There's always been ritual that right. goes with cremation. In our country, we're just beginning to do that because it was marketed in a different way.
Right. Well, and you talked earlier when we visited the crematory, you talked about some of the things that people want now. And yeah. Caitlin, you write about different disposal rituals. Sprinkling ashes at sea is very popular in San Francisco, mm-hmm. for example. I'm sure there are people from Iowa who go out to sea.
There was a gentleman on TV the other night here in Missouri that I saw that put the cremated remains of some of cremated remains in fireworks, and they were doing that, you know. So
there people are do you sense that people are getting more comfortable with these remains and thinking about them as a keepsake almost?
I think so, but it's interesting because Caitlin talks about marketing and that, and I think there's a lot of different things out there, you know. But everybody's different. One family member might think that's really cool, and it's like the other person may, you know. So I don't know if it's right or wrong. It's whatever you want to do, you know.
I want to get back to the phones. Kay is on the line in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
And this is something you have a lot of experience with.
Well, I grew up in a funeral home. I was the third generation in a funeral director family. We're no longer in the funeral business, but my children also grew up in the funeral home. And by the way, my parents also helped put 21 young men through college at Iowa Wesleyan as they kept them in their home. And my mom washed and ironed for them, but they also helped in the funeral home. So I understand where you're coming from as far as being a student.
Right.
I feel very strongly right now that I'm wanting to be an advocate for dying with dignity. I find that to be very important as far as how you look at death. My husband died 4 years ago, and he was told a month before he died that he was going to go. And we did have hospice and found it to be so comforting. And all my grandchildren came in to his room and spent time with him, and they had time to reminisce, and he explained to them that, you know, that he wasn't going to be with them anymore, but the memories were just wonderful. And so at his death, it was a very close family feeling because we could all be with him, and it was a wonderful thing. I want to say one other thing about planning a funeral. Now, my family is a fun-loving, and you've got to remember that we've been in the business a long time. But at my husband's funeral, we did something. Here's the thing. I think that we should not be told what to do. I mean, we shouldn't have these feelings that you must read this scripture and you must sing this hymn and, you know, all this kind of thing. And I've seen those changes throughout the years. But we had at my husband's funeral, we had a friend sing, "I'll Be Seeing You." And at the end of the service, we played the Iowa fight song.
Oh, nice.
And we really felt, you know, that this was a true celebration of his life. And and I have to add one more thing to the crematorium thing. Now, I told you we're a fun-loving family. My husband rode on Ragbri with my son this year. So,
oh, wow. So he took his ashes with him.
In one of those little containers. So there you go.
All right, Kay, thank you so much for sharing your experiences. Michael, you wanted to respond?
There's a wonderful movie that I don't know if maybe many of you have watched. It's called The Way, and it came out a couple years ago with Emilio Estevez and Martin Sheen. It's a true story about a young man who goes to walk the way of St. James between France and Spain and dies, and his father comes and scatters these. And it's a very spiritual and really a faithful movie, but it's so well done that I'd really encourage anybody to, you know, it's not for everybody, but it's beautifully done.
We have this comment from Mary Kay in Johnston. She says, I wanted to bring up a beautiful Japanese film entitled Departure, which treats the care of the dead body so reverently, mm-hmm. and she recommends that. She also says, I work in hospice care. I'm continually amazed by how much we educate and tend to expectant parents about their pregnancy and that first year of life for the infant, but that we rarely do that good a job educating people about death. And Caitlin, I know that this has become your mission, is to help people become more comfortable with death and to give people an opportunity to have a good experience when they lose a loved one or when they themselves die. Was there something that you saw that made you think, I need to be involved in helping people have a better experience?
I think it was just hearing sort of the conversation like we're having today, hearing these beautiful experiences, all these different ways to do things, and then
I guess, comparing that with my actual experience in the crematory and knowing that most people didn't know that they had those options. And most people didn't understand that all of those things were on the table and they really didn't have to do, like she was just saying, have to do the same scriptures, have to do this thing that doesn't necessarily mean a lot to them, that the options were wide open and that the good death could be defined by you and your family and what you believe in and what rituals you want and what the person was like, and that those options are on the table. And that's what inspired me, and continuing to have really open conversations like this are what keeps it going.
So when someone comes to you, and I know that you've been through mortuary school, you've done a lot to really open up the dialogue with online chats and now this book, to open up this dialogue. But when somebody comes to you, what kind of options can you offer them? How do you open that conversation?
Well, I say, I mean, in a way, I am an advocate for a couple of things. I'm an advocate for the family taking care of the body themselves. I'm an advocate for natural burial, meaning the body just being buried straight into the ground in a shroud or a quick decomposing casket. Mm-hmm. I'm an advocate for witness cremations, the family being present for the cremation. And a lot of people, I'm not saying that you have to do that. It's not, you know, if you don't do this, you're doing it wrong. But most people that I talk to just have no idea that those things are on the table. And sometimes you can see it kind of blow their minds. And that doesn't mean that they're going to go out there and take care of their mom's body entirely on their own when she dies. But those seeds are planted, and it does change their perspective on how much control and power they can have when somebody dies.
And Michael, I know we've talked about there are more options than most people know about. How do we find out about that? If let's say we're beginning hospice care, or we're thinking about our own deaths and want to make a better plan for ourselves.
One, I think, as somebody in funeral service, I think one, we have to be educated about those options, but we as funeral service people have to be open to explaining those. On the other hand, there's the internet. So it's like, my goodness, you can pop things into the internet and things will show up. I mean, there are a lot of different things. There's a company called Passages International, which does, you know, scattering tubes and all these sorts of things. And the caskets we were talking about with that Caitlin just said. So I think part of it is for me and people like Caitlin and I to be very open to that. Because there may be certain regulations within whatever somebody wants. But I think people have to want that information, and not everybody wants it, you know. So I think it's just but providing it to those who definitely want it.
Michael, thank you so much for being here
today. Thank you.
Michael Lensing of Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. And Caitlin, do you think that we are experiencing a new openness about death? Do you feel like this dialogue is opening up?
I do. I started being public with my advocacy about 4 years ago. And just in the last 2 years, there's been an explosion of people wanting to death cafes, death salons, major media coverage of hospice care, of end-of-life issues. There really is, I think, a renaissance in how we're handling death, and the internet speeds that up. Our communications speed that up. So we're in a good time. It's a good time to be in death and to be working with death, and it's exciting because I know that people are going to get options that they didn't know were possible.
Caitlin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Caitlin Doty is author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. You can find her on Twitter at The Good Death. Talk of Iowa is produced by Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, your comments on things you have heard on the show. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about body image issues and the power of positive self-talk. This is Talk of Iowa.